This podcast is a member of the Mud Puppy Games Network.
Welcome to Designers and Discourses, a podcast in which we interview tabletop game designers and discuss their influences and inspirations. In tonight's episode, we talk to Michael Curtis, author of The Chained Coffin, both an adventure and a setting for the Dungeon Crawl Classics role-playing game. Welcome to our first episode. Before we begin, I thought I'd take a minute to introduce the show format and let listeners know what to expect. One of my biggest frustrations as a game writer is whenever I'm asked to talk about something that I've designed in what is usually a very condensed amount of time and space, like at a convention panel discussion, or in a blog post, or a podcast interview. Being able to sum up a work in short, concise terms is important and useful, but I usually have a lot more to say about what I did and why I did it. So given that, the premise of Designers and Discourses is to provide a more expansive venue for game designers to come on the show and talk to us about their creations and their creative process. These will be one-on-one interviews that may ramble quite a bit, but that will be by design and intent. And game design and intent is exactly what we'll be discussing. For this premiere episode, I've asked my good friend and well-known podcast pilot test subject, Mr. Michael Curtis, to show up and help me broadcast strange voices across the internet. Among his many fine RPG works is an adventure called The Chained Coffin, and that's what we're going to discuss tonight. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you for having me, Jim. Hopefully this episode will actually see air and it won't be condemned to the vaults as the lost episode, and we'll re-record in a week or so.
The lost episode of Spellburn.
Yes.
As far as I know, it exists nowhere but on my hard drive. Maybe Joe Bittman's hard drive, but yeah.
Well, once the technology comes along where we could actually, you know, adjust the audio, in 100 years, it will be dug up. But in the meanwhile, we'll just have to entertain people tonight with this show. So,
well, I didn't just pick you because you were a good friend of mine and I knew you'd say yes. This is something that I'm very, very interested in. And on the off chance that there are Philistines out there somewhere in the listening audience who are unfamiliar with The Chained Coffin, go ahead and give us the elevator pitch. What was The Chained Coffin?
So The Chained Coffin is an adventure that I pitched for Joe Goodman a year or two ago. It's difficult to recall at this point. But it started with a very singular image, a mental image in my head. I pictured this kind of rugged mountainscape with this party of adventurers kind of dragging this coffin up the side of the mountain with like a lightning storm going on in the background and stuff like that. I don't know where the idea came from, but I said, okay, there's got to be something here. So originally I pitched the idea to Joe about like this, this rainstorm washing up this kind of weird futuristic looking pod or some weird, alien or lost civilization artifact and something in it beginning to talk to people. So that was kind of the first genesis of the idea. I said, okay, I want to do something different with this. So I kind of cast around for ideas, and the idea of that mountainscape and that thunderstorm just kept calling to me. So I started thinking about where I could set this, and that kind of led me to the Appalachian Mountains. And then from there, it was a short jump to Manly Wade Wellman, because with Dungeon Crawl Classics, Joe was very adamant that we go back to the famous appendix and the stuff that Gygax was looking at when he was penning, when he was evolving D&D. That's why I knew that we would have a kind of, I knew Joe would be good with the idea with that if I could couch it within Manly Wade Wellman. Wellman, for the most part, is generally considered the Silver John character. Is basically the kind of the proto bard.
Right.
That's why he gets the callback. That's why Wellman gets the callback by Gygax. So Gygax didn't really do anything with like the actual Appalachian setting. It was more the idea of this kind of character who performs, who knows songs and folklore and helps deal with a problem by kind of like the strolling, wandering adventurer type.
Right.
So, but the actual settings of the stories, Wellman was writing in the 50s and the 60s, are obviously not really tied in kind of the pseudo Western European medieval era that it's, you know, D&D and fantasy role playing largely conveys. So, but yes, yeah. If you go back in there, he is official Appendix N. So yeah.
You caught me with my AD&D pants down. I missed that.
It's okay. No, everybody. That's why everybody overlooks Wellman. I'm kind of used to it. In fact, when the Chain Coffin first started coming out, one of the big things we were selling it with it was that it was kind of inspired by the writings of Wellman. And I literally probably 7 people out of 10 who had no idea who Manly Wade Wellman was. I wish that I had some sort of stock in Paizo before I wrote this, because I think I single-handedly bumped their Planet Stories collection of Who Fears the Devil up to like at least 6 or 7 notches up the up the top 10 list.
I just, in preparation for this podcast, I just recently read Who Fears the Devil, and I gotta tell you, I owe you big, and I'm sorry that it took me that long to actually read it, because it was wonderful, wonderful, wonderful stuff. I mean, especially the short story format, where you can just buzz through 3 or 4 of those in an afternoon and have a great time.
Right. It's one of those things that we've talked about in other podcasts, especially when it comes to Dungeon Crawl Classics, is for the most part, I believe that it fits kind of that short story, that episodic feel, rather than say, that's one of the reasons I keep going by and say, keep maintaining that the Mega Dungeon is not the greatest setting for Dungeon Crawl Classics, despite the name. It's more of, kind of get in, have the adventure, and then move on to the next exciting location.
Right.
We'll talk about that some more too, because that has a lot to do with the way I design things.
Well, just up front, I want to try and focus on your design intents. Okay, so which you've described very well. You started out with sounded to me like a very typical Michael Curtis idea of it's going to be something from outer space, but then got to Manly Wade Wellman. But that must have the design intent is not just to lift the culture of the Appalachian Mountains. It comes with some things inherent in it, in that setting. And those stories, the mountain folk, the way you comport yourself, your manners that you display are very important to the mountain folk, for example. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting situation to put player characters in a Dungeon Crawl Classics game into.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it goes back to even in the original, the original OD&D, there was the small section about, if people get too big for their britches. I mean, like, what do you do when the 10th level, when the 10th level fighter is like starts rampaging over the local 0-level townsfolk? What do you do to stop that? And there's, Gygax reveal, he talks about there's always the torches and pitchforks response that, yeah, they might be a 0-level character, in and of themselves, but you get enough of them together and they prove to be a threat. I mean, manners are very important in Wellman's stories, and so that ties into the setting, and that's something that I wanted to bring into it. And to kind of keep the characters from running roughshod over, these humble little mountain folk, most of them are just, poor farmers, and they're just kind of like, hard scrabble, just kind of getting by. The fact that there are these kind of interrelated families and everybody kind of knows everybody in the backwoods, if you're a real jerk, they're going to, they'll basically tell you where to get off. I get the example is if you're very forthcoming and you're very friendly and you behave yourself very well, sure, you get a free meal out of it. You get a safe place to sleep at night. If you don't, well, you get directed to go sleep in the bog where the snakes are going to bite you in the middle of the night, that kind of thing. And then, of course, if you abuse one of the family, word is going to spread, and before you know it, you're not getting any assistance whatsoever. So you're not so much in danger of being, being killed, but kind of the idea of being the social, like a social outcast or being ostracized by the local community, then you've lost any sort of native support that you might be able to rely on. So yes, the manners are very important, and it does tie into kind of that whole mountain culture. So. It was intended, and power gamers, feel free to go and rampage to your heart's content, but don't be surprised when it comes back and bites you in the ass. So.
Well, a particular short story that reminded me of the way you've written The Chain Coffin is Desrick of...
Oh, yes. Desrick of...
starts of with a Y. Yeah. Yander.
Yeah, Desrick of Yandro.
Yep. Sorry, my dyslexia was trying to turn that into a Star Trek episode, Alien Yondru. Anyway, because there's a character in that story that's the rich Richie Rich outside guy who Silver John is guiding through the mountains toward his goal, and he's continually being told, watch out for this, 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 and getting this list of mythical creatures that he doesn't believe in until, of course, he inevitably is confronted by them. And in your module, as in much of Dungeon Crawl Classics, there are monsters in there that are not your standard skeleton or your standard ghoul or your standard devil or demon. You know, a little something to surprise jaded players with.
Right. And in that situation, what you don't know can kill you. So if you purposely or inadvertently ostracize the people who know what exactly is going on, well, then you don't have access to that that line of information. So what you don't know any hints about what you're going to deal with. And, well, you know, you have to kind of deal with the consequences of that. So
I've got a question I'm dying to ask you. What, we've known each other 4 or 5 years now by this time?
Something like that. This was like my first GaryCon. So this was, I think this will be my fifth GaryCon. This will be 2016 is like the fifth one. So,
well,
so
we're friends, and I know you well enough that I know you had a career in Hollywood at one point. I don't want to talk about that because we'll get into bear suits and other indelicate subjects. But knowing that you do have that background, I don't know if you play a musical instrument or not yourself.
No, I don't personally. I mean, I've had like 3 or 4 years of trombone in middle school. I mean, that's about as close as I get. I was in a very bad punk rock band for a couple of years, and I could thump a little bit about on a bass guitar, but you know, I really don't have an access to any sort of musical talent.
That would be enough to lead you to enjoying the exposition through verse that takes place in the Chain Coffin.
I mean, yes.
I mean, you wrote that little ditty that was in there.
It did. I am responsible for that. Yes. but that's basically the distilled element of 100 blues songs and backwards recordings, kind of all distilled into some sort of rhyme scheme that sounded appropriate for that kind of music, and then kind of fooling around with that and trying to do something where I didn't embarrass myself too badly.
Well, and of course, blues and folk mythology, particularly mountain folk mythology, go hand in hand.
Oh, right. Yes, I was drawing very much on Americana blues music because, I mean, at its heart, the Chain Coffin is entirely Americana. So, I mean, it's folklore, it's actual geography, it's actual people and stuff like that, just kind of all put together in a very, very fun and enjoyable setting. So yes, of course, I'm going to draw on actual music. So,
well, I want to talk a lot about inspirational sources other than Manly Wade Wellman, but before I move to that, I want to talk about one more thing that seemed to me to be a design intent. I mean, to an extent, this is in every adventure module if it's written well, but there's some really nice things in there that seem to borrow from Wellman and just good game design in general, in that it's part of the thrill of the adventure. I was fortunate to be in one of the playtest groups for this, so we got to play it before it was even published, is that you've got to know who to trust and who not to trust. And you've presented the NPCs very much in that mountain folklore way where, for example, we did not trust Zugan in the coffin, the cursed cleric. We were very suspicious of him when we shouldn't have been, and there were players lining up to do deals with Black Cloak.
that's actual. I don't know so much. I knew that Zugan was going to be a hard sell. I knew that it was going to be, I mean, because your natural, and that was part of the fun of actually designing the adventure, because it'd be one thing if it was you find the Chain Coffin, and the way it's written, I mean, it's this ghastly looking thing with all sorts of evil symbols written upon it and the rest of it, which makes sense if you're trying to kind of contain a good or a lawful cleric. But, I mean, your average player, we find this coffin with all these evil symbols on it, and there's something inside who claims to be this person. There's obviously going to be trust issues. And I purposely wrote in there because one of the there is a rough time limit on how much time you have to kind of do the adventure and kind of try to confront the big, bad catastrophe that's waiting in the wings. So you can kind of track down and do your follow up and figure out if this guy is who he says so. But that's going to takes away from how much time you have to complete, your little mission thing.
This has been out for a year. I don't think we have to worry too much about spoilers.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I'm still trying to coach you because I don't want to ruin anybody. The Black Oak is just, I mean, if you get what you deserve, if you go into that kind of purposely hoping that you're going to, cut a deal with the devil. That I actually, if you read the adventure, I address the meta gaming aspect of that. I mean, a lot of players are like, oh yeah, it's a devil. Okay, I'll sell my soul to the devil, and he's going to collect it in 20 years or what have you. It's like the campaign's never going to last that long. You know, hey, no problem. Let's get something.
This is a convention one shot. What do I care? I sell my soul.
Exactly. It still doesn't really work perfectly as a convention, like a convention one shot, because that's the whole Shutter Mountain. So it really works better when you have a lot of room for the setting and for the characters to breathe. But I mean, if you're playing that in a average, weekly, bi-weekly campaign, even still, you're like, maybe the campaign has a year. My character is, I'll get the goodies now and don't worry about it. And there's a little sidebar that addresses all that. And yeah, well, you get, in the mountains, you get what you, there are consequences you're asking. So you deal with the devil, you get in bed with the devil and, wake up in hell. I forget what exactly the saying goes, but yeah. So design intent. I'm glad it works kind of as it does. There's a whole uncertainty, and that works on two levels too. Not only are you uncertain with the NPCs you're dealing with, but you're going into kind of unexplored territory. I mean, you don't really know anything about the mountains themselves or the people there or what you're going to find there. So, there's this whole thread of uncertainty running through the entire adventure from start to finish. So,
how much of a challenge was it for you personally to take something that was, at least in large part, inspired by fiction that's set in mid-20th century Appalachia and figure out how that's going to work in a medieval fantasy setting? I think you did a fantastic job, but I'm a fan, so...
Well, thanks. It's actually wasn't all that difficult for me, because I think the main issues with, I think the things that would really make it jarring for, with something that you're set in the stories, like I said, they're set like the 1950s, 1960s, Wellman was writing them. So for him, they're contemporary tales. But because the setting is so rustic and, Appalachian mountain folk, there's not a lot of technology there. So you don't have to worry about, you don't have to like, oh, well, now I have to change all the tractors into horses or oxen, in order to plow the fields. I think the major things would be, like, there were certain monsters that, the whole setting is drawn on actual American folklore. So there were certain things that I knew I couldn't do. Like, I couldn't really put Bigfoot in there, because that kind of pulls you out of the setting. As soon as you see, like, okay, a Sasquatch or something like that, I mean, we associate that with, In Search Of or whatever crap is on the History Channel these days, people go and squatching. So it was more a matter of drawing on folklore that wasn't so much well known. I mean, some people might know about it, but for a larger audience, I know I impressed you because I pulled an actual character from Kentucky folklore and kind of merged that with another character and inserted that into the module. But
that's why it's a privilege to know you and get to play in the same ballpark you play in, because that was the greatest call ever the day you called me up and said, hey, when you were a kid growing up in Kentucky, did you ever know about the Popelik monster, and did you ever go out on the railroad tracks?
Right.
I already knew you well enough then to know you're a Long Island boy, so I was astonished that you had any idea about what to me was a local legend.
Right. All the little monsters were either stuff which was so prevalent, like ghosts, or were something which was just file the serial numbers off a little bit, and nobody would know where it came from. So I think that was the real issue. Aside from that, I mean, it being a rustic mountain setting, I mean, you could pretty much drop that anywhere. So it wasn't too difficult to adapt that. At least I didn't find it to be. In fact, I found it to be a lot of fun. I think one of the stretch goals we came up with was we had to do like 10 different versions of like the Bad Lake Beast. And so that was me going through a lot of websites and a lot of books about, Appalachian folklore and, even things about like New Jersey pine barrens and stuff, and just kind of getting these esoteric lore and figures and, creatures that I knew about from reading, books on cryptozoology from a kid or weird UFO books or that kind of thing, and using those as a basis for these new creatures. And, so far nobody's really called me on them. So I think I did a good job. Nobody said, oh yeah, that's this creature from, that's the Lynchburg frog man or something like that.
And unless I missed them, nothing lifted directly from even Manly Wade Wellman, where you'd go, okay, that's this creature from that story.
Right, I think so. Yes. It was more, yeah, right. There was a, I think there was one which is kind of vaguely from that. I forget what there was one creature. One creature who has almost like his hands were described almost as spades. Like he had like shovel-like hands. I think I incorporated that with one of the monsters. But for the most part, I mean, Wellman was drawing from actual folklore creatures himself. Like as we're talking about the deserts of
Sure.
Yandra, those are all actual Americana like folklore, like lumberjack. Like those are real creatures in like lumberjack mythology. So we were drinking from the same still, you know, if you want an analogy there.
Well, to skip ahead briefly to some of the design concerns, even though that's later in the show notes, I mean, did that give you pause that here I am, a New York boy, writing about the Appalachian Mountains? I remember in the playtest, Rick Hall ran the playtest for us. He was, because he does playtest for Joe, and I got to be a player instead of the GM, as I normally. And Rick asked us specifically, after we'd completed one whole session, were any of us offended in any way by the cultural presentations? Because the majority of the table had grown up in. I'm in Cincinnati, and a bunch of people were from Kentucky, and plus me, my family's from East Tennessee, up in the mountains. I'm three generations removed from the people Wellman was writing about.
I was, you know, my only concern was it wouldn't sound authentic. I mean, my background itself is I always say that I'm hillbilly Viking, because my ancestors on my paternal grandfather's side, they're Scotch Irish. They came over and they settled in the Carolinas, you know, just prior to the Revolutionary War. So I mean, so they were living in the mountains. They married, you know, local native women, and you know, I mean, they were the progenitors. I remember watching there was a you know History or Discovery Channel, the series on the Appalachians, and they're talking about the early, you know, the early history, like the mountain folk, and I'm like, this all sounds, you know, frighteningly familiar. And I mean, I went to school in the Catskills, so the Catskill region of New York. So it's not, you know, it's not the, you know, that's not the Mid-South, but it's still, there's still similarities with the landscape and with the people and that kind of lifestyle.
You know what I mean, though? I mean, because God bless Gary Gygax, whom I have immense respect for, but no one would re think to release a setting guide called Oriental Adventures in 2015.
Well, I mean, I wasn't worried about I wasn't worried about alienating or offending anyone because I just, I mean, I didn't disrespect that culture. I mean, I approached that the same that Wellman does. I mean, he approaches it with great respect. I didn't drag in like, you know, Yankee yellow journalism where, you know, when the Hatfield and the McCoy, you know, feud broke out. I mean, that was all in the northern newspapers. Yeah, you know, a bunch of back scratching hill folk, you know, shooting each other. You know, I mean, that whole kind of stereotypical hillbilly thing we got is kind of, you know, is kind of the descendant of that yellow journalism. And I eschewed all that. I mean, I didn't even touch that. I mean, I didn't, there's not like, you know, I mean, there's no deliverance jokes in there or anything like that. I approached the material and the people with great respect, even to the point of religion. I mean, I didn't want to offend anybody by, you know, like by throwing in, you know, a random encounter with snake handlers or anything like that. You know, if you want to do that, go ahead, but you're not going to find it in the setting itself. So.
Well, I mean, I agree, and you did a wonderful job. Maybe Rick didn't quite understand what he was supposed to ask in terms of does it feel authentic versus does it offend any of you guys? Because you know we were like, are you kidding? We just got to take down a whole cabin full of hillbilly giants. It was great.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I can say, yeah, I mean, that was one of the things. You know, I mean, if the monsters are, you know, the monsters are kind of stereotypes, that's one thing. But, you know, quote unquote, like the good people, the shun folk themselves, were all handled with great respect. So yeah, I wasn't too worried about anybody being offended by that. In fact, I've gotten a lot of good feedback from people who grew up in that area, you know, amongst yourself and other people who love it because nobody has ever set, you know, like a, you know, a fantasy role-playing adventure basically in their backyard. I mean, it's all, like I said, these kind of pseudo Western European medieval thing with a castle on the hill and, you know, peasants and, you know, all the rest of that stuff. So I'm very happy to be, as far as I know, the first person to make, you know, make this Appalachian setting into this fantasy, campaign, you know, like mini campaign. As far as I know, nobody else has done something like that. So I can't complain.
Well, here's a line of questioning that I want to pursue with everyone I have on the show. As an artist and writer myself, I know that inspiration comes from many sources. And then there's the other side of it. The people who read or appreciate the work later will bring their own connections to the work that maybe sometimes the author didn't have or didn't intend. So I'm both interested in what your inspirations were aside from Manly Wade Wellman for this. And then I have some questions about things that it reminded me of to ask you if you were thinking that too.
Okay.
For example, the I'll respect your judgment and not go into heavy duty spoilers, but in the climax of the adventure, there was a scene that everyone at our table immediately went, this reminds us of the Errol Otis art for the cover of Deities and Demigods in AD&D. Oh.
All right. Yeah, I was actually, I saw the show notes and I was wondering why that was there, because that actually played no, I mean, I love Errol, I love his stuff and I love seeing him down in Texas every year and, you know, he's great to have at the table and everything. But that cover had absolutely nothing to do with the kind of the climax of the adventure. Joe Goodman, like prior to this, like he put like a there were certain things like he said, you know, he kind of had like this little bullet list of ideas that, oh, maybe we could do an adventure like this, you know, maybe we can tie that into it.
Oh, I've got to ask you a question that's a complete side tangent while you're talking about what you're talking about. How do you have that conversation with Joseph? How did you have that conversation with Joseph and dinosaurs not end up in the Shudder Mountains?
Oh, because they had no place in there.
Okay.
that was no problem. I mean, I've already done my I've already had one module with a dinosaur show in it for a good minute, so I'm done. I don't have to actually technically two. So yeah, so I've hit my my dinosaur thing. In fact, there should be a dinosaur ban coming up probably. It'll be right after the Ziggurat ban has been lifted. We're probably no dinosaurs for a while. But as we were talking, yeah, one of the things that going around, like he had this idea for kind of like he had this idea for like giant creatures fighting. I think that was, you know, he was thinking more like Godzilla or, you know, King Kong or something like that. And that was one of the ideas. So I thought, like, oh, what about a big climax, like big giant, you know, creatures fighting all over this, you know, this kind of hidden place up in the mountains and stuff. I was like, that'd be kind of cool. I mean, it wasn't like the centerpiece of the dungeon, but I was like, yeah, you know, I need a little kind of closing set piece. And, you know, good and evil in giant forms fighting out, that just worked. So as much as I would love to say, yeah, I lifted it from Errol's piece, I did not make that ascension until I saw. I did make that association until I saw your show notes. So absolutely nothing. The answer to that, yep, no.
Well, I'm just kidding about Joseph and the dinosaurs because Joe gives great notes.
So, we are talking about other inspirations, and Wellman gets like the, you know, he gets the big nod. I mean, this is, you know, kind of the rough idea for the setting itself is, you know, 80% Wellman and, you know, 20% other thing. But I realize in retrospect, after I had kind of gotten halfway through the adventure, that image that I had, the idea of like the party adventure dragging this coffin over this mountaintop and like this thunderstorm going on, I realized that actually that idea I got from William Faulkner, and that's basically As I Lay Dying distilled down into a single image. So not only do we have like this Appalachian feeling on that, but there's also some Southern Gothic in there as well. So I was telling one person, I was like, yeah, where the idea of the module came from? And when you're able to whip out like William Faulkner, I mean, so I mean, it's not, you know, it's not another Conan knockoff. So
I, now that you say it, it's obvious, but it hadn't occurred to me at all.
Yeah, exactly, because you're not prone to, you know, associate, you know, pulp, sword and sorcery with, you know, great American novels. And I think, you know, maybe we should start doing that more often. Maybe there's this great untapped reserve of inspiration that we're sitting on, and we just don't because we're so used to, you know, focusing on, you know, the pulp classics, you know, our Elric and our Conan and our Fafnir the Grey Mouser and what have you, when there's a whole bunch of other stuff out there that, you know, they're myth. You know, so there's the hero's journey. There's a lot there other than fantasy.
See, now we're getting down to it because, as you and I both well understand, the creative process, these things come up out of our own memories from all directions.
Right.
And you sit there like you're putting together a jigsaw puzzle, and when a piece fits, you're like, Eureka, chunk.
Yeah, so that's and there are different inspirations, and sometimes you're surprised what leads to an idea, which leads to another idea, and it's the classic pebble, the classic pebble falling that causes the landslide. So
Okay, here's an easy question.
okay.
This is an ABC question. At the end of this episode, over the credits, you would like to hear played musically Johnny B. Goode by Chuck Berry, The Devil Went Down to Georgia by Charlie Daniels Band, or a song of your own choosing, and what would that be?
It would be Lead Bellies in the Pines.
Oh, see, that's so much better.
That I had that one pretty much on terminal repeat when I was writing this. So yeah, that was I love that rendition of the song. So if you can find a copy of that.
I think what we're discovering here is that you're much more cultured than I am in your taste.
Well,
I mean, I'm like, D was it inspiration from the Deities and Demigods cover? And you're like, no, actually, it was Faulkner.
Well, I have this, I literally have an English degree. I might as well do something with it. I'm still paying the student loans off for it. So,
Well, okay. While we're talking about inspirations, and you were talking about Joseph giving you notes on the adventure. Let's talk about the differences between drawing from literary and other primary sources and the inspirations that come from collaborations. This is a question that I hope to have Doug Kovacs on the show, and I want to
Okay.
ask him the reverse of this question. But I know from experience that as you're writing these things, Doug or another artist will be illustrating them, and that because this is a Good 'n Games product, there's usually some sort of dialogue back and forth. So it's almost never the case that the writer turns in a copy and says, "This is your description for the monster," and Doug or another artist just runs off and does it. Doug will respond back with art sometimes in mid manuscript, right? Or you're at a convention discussing these things, and how did that go? Did that
Okay.
for the Chain Coffin? Did that happen? Because the Bad Luck Monster looks very Kovacsian to me.
Okay. All right. I.
Describe that process as it
All
happened.
right. All right. Okay. Actually, I've done. I mean, Doug has illustrated the majority of stuff that I've written. Basically all of the DCC stuff. So, I mean, I trust him. I give him basically what he wants to go, and I have not been disappointed with like his renditions of like the monster. I'm pretty sure I don't have it on me, but I'm pretty sure he also did the Sin Eater as well. And if that's the case, I'm 99.9% part of that he did that one, and that one that came out far better than I had described in there. I'm very happy with that. However, I have to say, and it's not. The collaboration with Doug on this actually took a turn for the worse, and it had absolutely nothing to do with Doug or I. What it is that if you saw him, okay, the big thing about how this whole thing started is that there's like kind of like a there's this combination lock puzzle involved
I know
that
exactly where you're going because
right,
in the play
exactly.
test we had three paper plates thumbtacked together.
Right. And there were, say, a limited number of possible combinations. So it was one, and so I mean, I there were three specific symbols that I wanted, and the symbols are kind of tied in together. So if you stare at it long enough, you could try to kind of figure out, which ones might be able to go. That's why I left a lot of it. I mean, there is a way to find the possible solution to it in the adventure itself, but there's also like if you stare at it long enough, you might be able to kind of deduce the proper combination of symbols, and that's what I had in mind when I had it originally put together. And then Doug illustrated it, and Doug did. So he not only did he just he was such a great job of doing these really cool, kind of esoteric alien symbols. That they're they each one is like steeped in all sorts of possibilities. But he also elaborated on the number of possible combinations. So I mean, by the time that Doug was done, I got the thing, and I couldn't solve it anymore. Because it had gone from maybe like a finite combination of like there was like four and then six and eight to like various symbols on each of the three dials, to there being like 24 symbols on like the big dial and 12 on the medium size and like 6 on the smaller one. So that was in pulling it off, it was an amazing job, and it's a great piece of art. But in playtest, it's much more convoluted than I had originally intended.
I hope that wasn't partly our fault, because in the playtest we cracked it the first try.
Yeah, but you were using the mock-up. And it literally is there were like three symbols which I designed, and like the rest of them were just general, you know, font. Like there was like a musical note and like a hashtag and stuff like that. Obviously things that didn't go. No, it wasn't your fault. It was just Doug just did an incredible job, and because he did an incredible job, he actually made it more difficult to solve. So that's like a plus and minus to it. But the minus is it was more difficult to solve, but even that has an upside, because it made me go back and I got to turn that little wheel, and I came up with like, I think, four or five other uses for it in a campaign that was part of the Kickstarter. And then I also worked that into another adventure that was one of the stretch adventures and stuff like that. So I got a lot of mileage out of it, other than it was originally supposed to be just kind of this little, we spin little dials around and we figure things out and hopefully all works well. So that was kind of that was Doug taking my idea and running with it. And while he did a really good job, and artistically it's really great, in the way that impacted the adventure was unforeseen. But I think it all worked out in the end.
Well, since you bring it up, this was conceived as a regular adventure module. What are those? About 16 pages and a cover with maps.
Yeah.
Then the idea of the wheel puzzle occurred, and the process of the Kickstarter, it telescoped up from all that to a box set with campaign settings, extra adventures, all this background material that, as far as I can tell, except for the little sub-adventure written by Steve Bean, you manhandled all by yourself.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Here's the question. When that happened, were you happy to have the broader canvas to paint on, or were you like, now where am I going to pull all this stuff out of the hat?
No, actually, I was very happy the way that came out. Because, I mean, I had so much fun designing that adventure that I told, like, even when I was submitting it, I told Joseph that it was like, okay, you know, if this one sells well, I want to do more here because I like the setting. So I was picturing maybe in like a year or two, I'd write a sequel like set in the Shutter Mountains again. The idea originally was just like to get the dials printed up in like heavy cardstock and laminated and all the rest of it and everything like that. And you know, I was just like, you know, it's a little. It's just such a minor part of the whole overall adventure. You know, I was like, you know, you really were making kind of like this big deal out of this stupid little puzzle and everything. But, you know, I mean, I trust Joseph. And I mean, I guess once again, I proved to be I'm the kamikaze pilot. I'm the test pilot. Joe comes up with a crazy idea. And for whatever reason, I just happen to have something that he decides to use me as kind of like the test dummy for. So like that was the whole first box set and everything that we did for the DCC adventures.
Paving the way for the what happened again later with the Purple Planet adventures. Right.
Well, I mean, this isn't the first time. I mean, the Dungeon Alphabet itself, if you look at that, like that whole kind of art mixed in with the text kind of layout thing, that was the dry run for the DCC rulebook. You know, I mean, just Joe had this idea, like, can we pull this off? So let's try it with this little 32-page supplement, and if it works, well, then that's what we'll do for the big main.
That
main
very movie. Rich content text wrapping around lots of art.
Right, exactly. So, you know, yeah, this Curtis guy, nobody knows him, so, you know, if he crashes or burns, you know, like, we can't, I always kid Harley, like, yeah, Harley's safe, you know, like, I'm literally the guy that pushed out of the plane first, you know, like, you know. So Harley's reputation is spotless, you know.
Well, yours too so far, but...
Yeah, so well, yeah, yeah, that,
you know, you're doing it in this podcast, being my test interviewee subject on right. The first episode.
Right.
You must be good at it.
Yeah, you know, I just don't care.
it's that mountain blood. You got restless feet, boy.
Right. Oh, yeah, that's another thing. We'll talk about, you know, design and restless feet. There's something that we talk about. And
go ahead, tangent away.
Oh, no, it was one of those things. It's like I mean, okay, I've done the Shutter Mountains, and I'm very proud of it. I mean, I love the Shutter Mountains as a setting, and I have more stuff there. But the other thing is that I realize is that here's my thing. I believe that there are two types of game masters, and you know, we're painting with a very broad brush here. Okay, I think on one hand you have what I refer to as farmers, and farmers are game masters who they are invested in their land. They're invested in their plot. I mean, they're world builders. They're like really into the mythopoeia. They're like Tolkien. They're the game masters who in 1974 they got their first box set, and they have been running D&D, you know, adventures and other adventures set in like their home campaign world for more than 40 years now. And Ed Greenwood, perfect example. I mean, the Forgotten Realms predates D&D. I mean, that will always be Ed's world. And that's great. I love that level of commitment. And like, you know, you can ask a real, you know, ask a game master like that. I'm like, you know, like, well, what's the culture here? Or what kind of currency do they use in the city of Cashamash? Or like, and they can give you an answer. It might have absolutely nothing to do with with the campaign itself. The adventurers may never know that. The players may not care, but they've kind of cultivated the setting, and it's their baby, and God bless them. And then there are people like me, and if they're farmers, I'm Johnny Appleseed, because I go and I come up with some ideas, and I like throw some seeds down and try to cultivate things for a little while, and things get growing. I'm like, oh yeah, that's cool. Look at that. That's neat. Oh, that's a great idea. And then I want to see what's over the next hill. And then so I start going over there, and then there's more ideas, the seed there, you know. So the Shutter Mountains is, I mean, that's one of just many. Especially now that Joseph's doing these, you know, the reprints with, you know, bonus campaign material and all the rest of that stuff, you know, like the reprint of Frozen in Time. There's that whole kind of mini campaign for the Forlorn North. So that was a lot of fun designing that. And with the Sea Queen Escapes coming out, if that funds with the new Kickstarter, there's a whole other mini campaign in there. And the Shutter Mountains kind of began as this mini campaign setting, but I had much more of a word count to develop it. So,
are you much of a comic book guy?
Not really. I mean, back in the 80s, I read a little bit. You know, I think I stopped reading like X-Men in like 88, 89. You know, in college, I read some of the DC Vertigo lines, like, you know, like Hellblazer, Sandman, and, you know, like Preacher, stuff like that. But the classic, like, four-color, you know, tights and capes and stuff like that, not so much.
Well, I just really liked the analogy there that you had between the farmer and the Johnny Appleseed, because a lot of creative people fall into those categories, and because comics are one of my big things, somebody like Jack Kirby had a hard time sitting still. He would explode ideas. I mean, the first 10 issues of New Gods have enough characters that a normal writer would have taken 100 issues to introduce, and then he's off to another comic. And then there are guys who, you know, Neil Gaiman would write as many issues of Sandman as somebody would let him.
Right. Yeah, I mean, no, I do. I mean, yeah, and I do get restless. You know, I mean, because I don't want to get bogged down. I don't want to paint myself into a corner. You know, because like if you come up with this great idea for, you know, such and such, like, you know, entire my campaign world and dwarves are all this, and you know, they're kings and they develop steam engines and all the rest of it. And that's a great idea. But if you come up with another idea which runs counter to that, like, okay, maybe the goblins. You know, the goblins have invented rockets or something like that. I mean, if it's in the same setting, you have to always worry about continuity and kind of rationalizing things and stuff like that. Where it's a, hey, you know, just burn things down. Or, hey, let's design an entire another world where, you know, this happens instead of this and all the rest of that. So, I mean, so that for that reason, I love my job. I mean, every new setting is just the next 10,000 word count away. Where were we?
we're just, you know, it started out as an interview and then it turned into conversation, and I think that's wonderful. So, I was up in my own head comparing my creative temperament with your analogy, and I think I'm more of your type than the other type.
Yeah, I mean,
it's like play styles in games. We're just right. Talking creative temperaments. We're not saying one's better than the other.
No, absolutely no. I mean, I'm totally in awe of people like Ed Greenwood, who, you know, built this entire, you know, setting and has reams and reams of material, or Tolkien, or, you know, like that kind of dedication is not something I can ever pull off. And, you know, and I do enjoy playing in that. But it's something I couldn't do. So yeah, so it's not a judgment call at all.
Judges and players fall into these similar categories. We have talked about this a lot on Save or Die because we've been working our way through the Gazetteers, and there are judges and players who like to be presented with a rich campaign setting.
Right.
And this actually will tie back to the Chain Coffin, so the principalities of Kiramikos or whatever, you know the names of the coins, and you know the languages, cultures, here's new classes, just copious NPC mm-hmm. descriptions and maps and things like that. And there are a huge segment, obviously, because the series was very popular and the audience is there for these things. You know, there are huge audiences for that who love it, and there are obviously creative writers who enjoy creating that. As a judge, I prefer to make up my own campaign and just steal the bits and pieces that right. I need. And there are players who like to switch, get tired of a campaign after a year and want to switch to a different game.
Mm-hmm. I think it even goes deeper than that on the player side. Everybody knows, like, there's Bob, and Bob always plays an elf. You know, it's like, it doesn't matter what we're playing, you consider playing like a barbarian. No, I want to play an elf. And he's happy with that. He can bring more to that, but there's also there's other players who are like, what's your favorite class or what's your favorite race? And I was like, I love them all. You know, as I said, I haven't played this in a while, so I'll play that, so even when it comes to choices in player participation, I mean, I guess you also get that as well. So,
well, let's talk about, I want to ask one more time if there were any other inspirational sources besides what we've discussed.
I mean, my head is just such a collection of stuff that, I will pull out, The Descent, the movie The Descent by who escapes me, but he also did 28 Days Later
I know exactly who you're talking about, and I can't think of it either.
Yes, but anyway, I totally ripped off. I like the idea of that story. There's these cavers go in the mountains the caves under Tennessee, and they run into this race. They run into some things down there, and I think the explanation they give it is they were kind of like Neanderthal or Cro-Magnon man who kind of went down too deep, and they kind of evolved into that lifestyle. And I think I riffed on that. I did take that in the backstory of the Shutter Mountains itself. And there's some Lovecraft in there too. There's a little bit of the Whisperer in the Darkness in there. The idea about these aliens coming down and mining the earth for minerals. Yeah, I pulled some of that in there too. So,
yeah, before we leave Manly Wade Wellman, I want to say that since my experience with him is very fresh, I was amazed because we've talked a lot about him being from that area, the Carolinas, and the mountain folk mythology that he brought to this. But for something that was written in the 50s and 60s, I was shocked that there were very thinly veiled references to some Lovecraftian themes and to what were then modern physics. I mean,
right.
the characters on a mountain in that culture getting into conversations that blend both magical concepts and cosmology. Physics, mm-hmm. which I just made it such a good read.
Yeah, I mean,
reading the book, I suddenly realized I'd seen a mountain based on I'd seen a mountain. Listen to me, I'd seen a movie based on John the Balladeer as a kid.
Yeah, you was the Legend of Hillbilly Jim, I believe, or
I don't even remember the exact title of it, but I have a pristine memory of John with his guitar on his back being chased by a stop motion giant vulture creature.
Yes, I think it was called it was horribly panned, but I think it's called The Legend of Hillbilly Jim, but I'm not 100% sure. Or maybe The Legend of Hillbilly John. But it was like a 73, I think, or 74. It was put out, and it did horrible. It was your classic kind of like B movie. I've never actually tracked down and seen a copy of it, but I know it's out there. So yeah. So if anybody finds it,
let me check YouTube.
Yeah.
No. Well, let's talk about some of the design concerns because we've touched on them. I mean, one design concern was, okay, here's this puzzle wheel. We could just print it on a page and tell the judge to cut it out and make his Xerox it and make his own. And that ballooned up. And you even have kind of touched on what I assumed was a hard sell to Joseph, when actually it wasn't. Because, I mean, all things being equal and not knowing anything about the Chain Coffin, if somebody just popped up at Random Game Company and said, "I want to write a D&D adventure that's based on, Appalachian tales from the mid-20th century," you'd be like, "What?" But J Joseph was already well on top of the Bard references in the Appendix N.
Well, I think, I think that has partially to do with it too. But I also think if Chain Coffin had been like my first thing for Goodman, I think it would have been a harder fight. Being, but he's, so he's, I mean, this is like the, that was like about this on the fifth or sixth thing I'd written for him, adventure wise. So he already knew that, I could pull this off and I would do something interesting with it. So it wasn't that hard of a sell. At least I didn't expect it to be. I don't know if he went through any, soul searching or whether he should pull this off or not. But it was, it's funny. It was, Doug Kovacs and I were talking about the Chain Coffin, last year when we were driving back from, for Game Hole Con. And Doug knew immediately what I was going for with this adventure, and I was very glad for that. And the, what it is, I think if you look at the history of DCC, the role-playing game, when it first came out, there were some people who grasped it immediately. I mean, they got the Appendix N stuff, or they got the kind of the, the swinginess of the system.
Picked up on the
And
vibe right away.
right, they picked up on the vibe immediately. And then there was a whole other people who were looking at it like this was just supposed to be like another kind of retro clone. It was supposed to be, it was supposed to be, they had gotten so used to AD&D, to D&D, like those expectations. So that when the book came out, they were reading the game, like they really didn't know, like they were trying to run your classic AD&D adventure with DCC, and there was a certain amount of, it just wasn't meshing, it wasn't working. So it took a while for people, like the switch in people's brains to turn, and then to kind of pick up what they were going for. And they were then the people really began to embrace that kind of like that gonzo, that wahoo, that swinginess nature of DCC. And I think to a point, actually, to a level which even Joseph Goodman didn't anticipate. I mean, this is my kind of interpretation of events. Like, I don't know if Joe kind of intended it to go as wacky, in some ways, or as kind of crazy as it did. But I'm sure he's glad it did. But I think,
I mean, he would have had to have been precognitive to have foreseen the way the game has exploded and the sea change that's happened in its popularity.
right. No, I mean, I agree on that, but I don't know if he was anticipating, kitten need sorcerers or
robot stuck in a time machine in a glacier.
Right, or Carnival of the Damned event, that kind of stuff. I mean, there is, and for a while, it just seemed that everybody was trying to like. In my opinion, like people just always thought that like, okay, DCC inherently had to be gonzo, it had to be balls to the wall, it had to be all sorts of craziness going on like all the time. And the Chain Coffin is kind of me pushing back against that expectation. It's, I mean, because it is grounded in kind of true, like true American. Like setting, because it's grounded in real people and real locations, it's not crazy, wacky, sorcery. It's not, everything is a little bit more low key, and in some ways, it's a little bit low magic. It's a little more reserved than kind of like the Gonzo thing. Like, there are no crash spaceships, there are no all the rest of it. I mean, it's very rustic, it's very quiet, and it's very creepy.
You have approached a complex subject that I love to think and talk about because it's the only analogy that comes to my head is a painter analogy that won't make any sense to you. But it's like painting with a palette knife. If you're a well-experienced artist and you use a palette knife, it's different than just cheating because a palette knife is easy, right? So Gonzo in DCC, what you're talking about is the adventure having verisimilitude,
Yeah, to somewhat. Yeah, I mean, I
not just
didn't.
being insane to be insane.
Right. It was me of, when you know that the knob goes up to 11, you also know that you don't always have to have it cranked up all the way. So there are sometimes when a quieter touch is more effective than, yeah, like, ha. So Chain Coffin was me definitely turning the volume down and kind of trying to lead by example and trying to get the idea, look, it doesn't always have to be spaceships or, you know, well, okay, in this adventure, we're all playing, you know, intelligent maggots burrowing through the body of a dead god, and that's where our adventures are or anything like that. Like, you know, it can just be, you know, these quiet little, you know, vignettes, these little kind of, you know, shadowy pines over the mountains and, you know, where you might have to deal with, you know, okay, well, they're, yeah, they're giants over the mountains and they're kind of little, you know, they're moonshine swilling, you know, characters, or, yeah, we have to, you know, the devil shows up, but he doesn't show up there, you know, throwing fireballs and, you know, all the rest of it. He shows up there with a pen and paper, you know, I mean, so that was
very, very nicely dressed in a black cloak.
Right. Exactly.
The most reasonable fellow on earth.
Right. Very much so. Very much so. So, so yeah, so in that way, so the design plan of that, a lot of what the Chain Coffin was me kind of pushing back against that and trying to say, okay, you don't always have to be crazy about that. And Doug picked up on that right away. And so at this point I knew, I mean, well, you know, I think there are a lot of people who like kind of work in like the inner circle, you know, especially with DCC, they pick up things a little bit better than people who aren't, you know, kind of, I don't know. I don't want to be dismissive or anything, but Doug knew exactly where I was going without me having to explain it. And I was glad for that. So I'm glad at least somebody knew where I was going.
Well, the people inside the circle just have the context to work it out, besides right. being very smart and very talented. Right. That's all you mean.
Right. Right. So that was one of the main design goals. I wanted something that was, it leaned a little bit more into horror than it did into, you know, what we call gonzo or wackiness and stuff like that. It was, you know, it was specifically supposed to be, you know, quieter. And you've played Call of Cthulhu with me, you know, I like that kind of that quietness, and I think that's more effective to me than, you know, like one of my favorite horror movies of all time is The Haunting, where nothing happens. You know, and it's still, this is a very, very eerie movie. So I was trying to do that with the Chain Coffin as opposed to, you know, some of the other stuff which I've done, which is much more loud and much more brash.
Which are just notes on the keyboard. Sometimes you play them, sometimes you don't. I mean, right. That Call of Cthulhu game, the most scared I've ever been in a role-playing game was you putting your glasses down into your nose and doing the granny voice. And
yeah.
she wasn't a lich about to disintegrate us. She was just a granny talking to us. And yeah. It spooked me out.
A guy who had run 7 games that weekend and had no voice left anyway. So.
That was great, Mike. I mean, the whole interview was worth it just to get to this point that you made.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
Because these are
still listening. This is the reward, people. There you are.
This is what every writer and every artist and every musician confronts is do, you know, okay, there's a through line. See if this makes sense. There's a through line that you could, if it's music, there's a through line that's the melody. Okay, now I'm going to play a jazz version of that and vary from the melody. And you can go all the way from that to some kind of crazy fusion jazz where the melody is almost unrecognizable.
Right.
Okay, I'm sitting down to do, you know, Project X today. Where on all of that do I want the slider bars in my adventure to be set?
Mm.
Or my piece of prose or my cover art?
Right. I think I found the right mix for the Chain Coffin, and by extent, I mean the entire Shutter Mountain setting itself. So,
you've certainly given me a lot to think about in the things that I write. So I appreciate that.
I hope so. I have to say also the Shutter Mountain is also its design philosophy. It's also kind of it's where I am. Mentally, kind of what I prefer these days, I have to say, is that I've grown largely bored with your kind of your vanilla fantasy elves, dwarves, halflings, humans kind of running around. If you read like, you know, the Shutter Mountain campaign stuff, I mean, it's very human centric to the point where there's actually rules in there for if you want to run a Shutter Mountain campaign where there are no elves, no dwarves, and no halflings. I'm finding that more interesting these days than having kind of everybody be kind of like a pseudo Tolkien Middle Earth setting. So that was very much going into that. It was kind of a palate cleanser for me, and it's actually what I prefer right now. I'm toying around with a couple of different settings and some other stuff, which I don't think I know one of them. Joe, I kind of pitched to him kind of an offhand, and he wasn't crazy about the idea. But it's still something I'd be interested in doing. I don't want to talk about it too much, but if you're a DCC third party person and you want to talk, you know how to get in touch with me. So, but yeah,
barred for hire.
Right.
Well, I want to. We'll finish with this because I don't want to wear either one of us out anymore. But I want to run a working theory of mine past you to get your response, because
okay.
it ties into what you were just discussing. There's in any creative effort that's a series, whether it's a television show, comic book movies, role-playing game adventures, there's always the genesis of the idea that comes from all these sources that we've been discussing, and it's always very fresh. But if it turns into a series, as it goes on, it will become less, inevitably become less and less about the primary source inspirations and more self-referential, more about itself. You know, so but you start out with original Star Trek. It's very much a parable of 1960s society, but by the time you get to Star Trek Voyager, it's a show about Star Trek. It's not allegorical science fiction anymore. You know what I mean? So the genius, comparable to what you just said about, okay, your standard medieval fantasy, how am I going to dress these goblins and orcs up in this dungeon? You know, that's a well-tilled field, you know, for 30 or 40 years now. How am I going to make it fresh? And the genius of DCC and what Joseph and you guys have decided to do is one way you can make it fresh is by going back to the primary sources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's true. Especially with the whole Shutter Mountain itself, is that I might be wrong. Like I said, it's been a year for a little while, and I had to crank out a bunch of stuff for the stretch goals. But I don't specifically think like how I handled orcs was I kicked them out. Like, there are no orcs in the Shutter Mounts as far as I'm concerned. There's no goblins. There's no, your classic kind of, everything is all, spooks and sin eaters and crossroad devils and man bats and the rest of that. So giant vultures. Giant salamanders, that kind of stuff, which again all ties in the setting itself. And I think what you're talking about, I think we run into that even before the adventure was released, because everybody was talking about the Chain Coffin, and to me, the Chain Coffin, the module itself, the adventure of the Chain Coffin, is just a small part of kind of the whole that's grown out of it. And to me, it's more about the Shutter Mountains now than it is about, the Chain Coffin. That was just one small facet of it. And I think the further adventures are going to come out of the setting itself. You know, I don't think we're going to have much in the way of, ties back into the original, to the point where the convention release we just did a couple months ago was with Tales from the Shutter Mountains, Volume 1. So it's a setting that we continue to build on. And I think in time, where more and more stories are set in this, it's going to take on its own personality, which I guess won't always be, 1950s, 1960s Appalachia dressed up in this fantasy garb. But with any luck, it will become, a unique thing of its own, even more so than it already is. So I think that's what you were getting at.
Well, just making an observation and not assigning a value judgment to it, just noticing that that's what you just articulated would go according to my little working theory, that it becomes more of its own thing.
Yeah, I certainly believe so.
Until you circle around on the track where you, as a creator or other judges and players, go, okay, I feel the need to go plant apple seeds somewhere else. And then back to primary sources, you'll go.
Right. Yeah, that will happen after DCC Blankbar.
I mean, if we could, time travel to 20 years from now and we're both still alive, we'll be doing a podcast probably about something besides DCC.
I hope so.
Or.
I hope that podcast involves what we're going to be doing with our billions of dollars.
Yes. Michael, I understand you're just invested in holographic role-playing games.
Tell
us about that.
I bought a moon.
Bought a moon.
I'm calling it Shutter Moon. I'm having the Shutter Mountains perfectly recreated there. A 1 mile equals 1 mile scale.
Well, thank you for doing this, sir.
Hey, no problem. I'm glad I could, say somewhat cognizant for the duration. No.
When it's my desire to broadcast strange voices out over the internet, I know who to call.
Okay, yeah. So, All right. So yeah, is there a particular way you want to close this? Do you want me to? I don't know. This is the dry. I mean, this is the dry run, to some sake. So.
Yeah, I didn't want to do corny stuff on
Okay.
this podcast. I'd rather it stay more earnest and straightforward.
Oh, all right.
But it can't just end in an ellipse. So, thank you
So.
for being on the show.
Hey, no problem, man. I wish you the best of luck with it, and I hope that you get some interesting people on, and they can entertain people for a while. So.
Obviously, we'll start with people I know best, so there may seem to be an initial focus on Dungeon Crawl Classics, but I promise that it's my goal to talk to anybody I can get to come on the show. If
All right.
and if you want to write in and suggest people to be on the show in the future, please write us at designers@mudpuppygames.com. And with that, I'll say good evening to you, sir, and thank you for being on.
All right, no problem. Thanks for having me. Bye, everybody.